group was putting on programs, the drama department, the physical ed department, there were people who were putting on dance programs through the afternoon, you know, one day or another. So that all, there was a lot of student participation, a great deal, and there was a lot of faculty participation. And we all felt very pleased with ourselves. There was one parade someplace, I can't remember, because I remember those banners that they had that were made, and a lot of people were making a lot of things. I don't remember what the function was, but the student body president was supposed to be that. And the student body president, a still good friend of mine, Dave Jessup, was also an ardent fisherman, and he decided that the most important thing in his life was to get up to the Sierra someplace, because that was the opening of the fishing season. And we said, you can't do it, because this is the dedication of the college, and you have to be here. And he said, there's a vice president that can take my place. And I remember, argue as we would and try to persuade him, Dave went fishing. The celebration went off quite well also. And that open house was continued for many years. And we got a big turnout of people. It was something to do on Sunday, mm-hmm. free.
So Founders Day was a big event for how many years do you think? I know it's died down recently. And it certainly opened the student participation.
No, there was some effort made even after the war, but after the war, when the whole college got so big, and there were so many different, even during the war, we lost the student participation, much of it because students were also working. Mm-hmm. See, during the war, many of them had jobs. I can remember kids falling asleep in my class, sound asleep right in front of me, who had worked on the night shift. I remember one very bright student, and I finally called him in and talked to him, and I said, you just cannot do two things at once. Well, my gosh, he was going to do them both at once.
He had a good job,
he was going to hold on to it, and he was going to come to class in the daytime, and I said, I simply cannot give you a passing grade if you just sleep through the class. And I forgot, and we came to some kind of a compromise about it. But there were just lots and lots of students who were working part-time or sometimes even trying full-time. Well, they had no interest in student activities. They didn't have time for them. So I know the biggest change, I think, came after the war.
I think that's even during the war. I think that stayed the same way then.
A lot of students are still working.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the students are working, or a lot of the students are older students. They're going back to school. Like
that's right. And they don't care anything about it. Yeah. No, that's
just... Don't really have time. Trying to raise a family, work,
sure,
and go to school.
Sure, no, and those... well, it started in the very late 30s, even before we got into the war, when the Convair and all of these wartime activities came along. Mm-hmm. And the students, of course, some of them were employed in the sensitive jobs and were not drafted for that reason. I mean, there were people who they felt were absolutely critical of certain, you know, people who had certain skills that they needed. But a lot of them, even some of the women were working down there.
You know, I noticed that it seemed as if the number of people teaching in the geography department went down a little bit during the 1940s. Were cartographers?
Oh, no.
It went down.
No, it went down in the 40s because we didn't have students for a while.
That's true overall. They didn't let a number of faculty members go.
That's right. I talked about England, as far as I was personally concerned, because I took a year as a maternity lead, and they were just tickled to death. You know, because
they had to cut down.
Fine. I came back and taught a semester. It was off a semester. I taught half time, and for a period of about 4 years or such a matter, I didn't teach full time all the time. You know, I mean, I wasn't there, and that was, as I say, very convenient as far as the school was concerned, because there were times when they needed to have a course taught, and that was a course that I could teach, and I did it. And so we lost, for instance, there was about Richardson, of course, was one who had been teaching and who went into, he went to work for the Bureau of Census. Who else in our department at that time? Lauren Post stayed with us most of the time.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Of course, Miss Clark had, she had retired before that time. But that was the point, that there were a lot of faculty. For the most part, I don't think anyone had to leave. I mean, it was left without something to do. A lot of them chose to do other things. Mm-hmm. They went into the war effort. I remember one friend, for instance, from the English department, who went to work for the government writing manuals, technical manuals, translating technical manuals into English, which the army could, mm-hmm. men could read, that kind of thing.
I recently talked to Clifford Baker, Spanish and
yeah,
French.
What did he do?
He was laid off.
Was he
because complete? He was, yeah, he was one of the more recent ones to mm-hmm. be hired, so mm-hmm. he was the first one to be
first
let go.
Gone. And I don't know whether he went into the war effort in any way or not.
I don't believe he did, no. Mm-hmm. He taught elsewhere at another school. Mm-hmm. And Dudley Robinson, I don't remember if he continued teaching, but I do know that he worked for the war effort as well.
Yes,
he taught
because I think the chemists were pretty well needed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What, were geographers needed as well?
Well, I'm trying to think what they went into. I know that there were just all kinds of jobs. I know that Bob Richardson, as they worked for the Bureau of Census, and he worked for something else in Washington before that time. But I can't give you any specific example of what any of those fellows did. Now, some of the people, well, I think of Don Ida Miller, who, see, we had a whole class of people in 41, it was in the spring of 41, who were about to graduate. They were seniors, and they were in the Navy Reserve. They had signed up for the Navy Reserve, and they were called up for duty
mm-hmm.
about a month before school closed.
Mm-hmm.
And we agreed, I remember the faculty meeting, there was some discussion, though not any great difference of opinion, that if they were doing passing work in the course at that time, we would assume that they were going to pass the course.
Yeah, I read so, that in the minutes as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and so we graduated quite a bunch of them.
Uh-huh.
As I say, that particular crowd went into the Navy. Now, Don, I don't know whether at that time, but I know later, worked particularly for the Meteorological Service of the Navy. And I can't tell you what some of the others did. Joe Davis was one of them, and he was a he's gone, he's dead long since, but he continued in the Navy, and he flew blimps up and down the coast.
Hmm.
Now, whether his background in geography had anything to do with it or not, I don't know. It's hard to tell.
I'm not so sure he could have gotten trained right there on the job.
But I'm sure that it helped him, and I don't think that was probably any reason why he was asked to do that.
I'm going to skip over again. I'm skipping around here a little bit. You start talking about a subject that I find extremely interesting, so I go off on it, but I'm going to get back to the other one here. How about the move from the old campus to the new? I haven't asked anybody about their opinions of it. Was it
well, it wasn't
going?
All that bad. A lot of stuff was boxed and, you know, like books and maps. Now that's, as far as the geography department was concerned, we didn't have that much equipment. We had wall maps, and we had a projector, and we had slides, and we had atlases. We had in the old college, a room that had some cupboards, and in that we had, I think, almost 100 atlases. We, at that time, we were able to levy student fees if we wanted to. I don't remember about that. In other words, we charged the students, I don't remember how much, a relatively small sum if they took a certain course.
Oh,
and
what
then
was it, a lab fee or something?
It was more or less like that. And then we bought this huge bunch of atlases, because atlases always have been expensive as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept them in this cupboard. And that room was open so many hours a day with a student assistant who kept track of those atlases. And so students who wanted to come there and do their work, draw maps or use the atlases, could do so. So I say we had atlases to move, and we had a few globes. It wasn't all that bad. The difficulty was on the other end, because as usual, things weren't quite finished. And sometimes a room wouldn't be quite ready because the floor hadn't been completely treated, or something else was wrong with it. And I can remember a picture I have someplace of a couple of men students scrubbing the floors and getting them ready. I think they were going to put down linoleum or something, or cork finish or something. But it wasn't all that disrupting as I recall.
Wasn't that bad?
No. Because the school wasn't that big. Now, I don't know what about the library. To the best of my knowledge, there were lots of students hired. Lots of students.
Just temporarily for this job,
and,
right?
And see, they did it between semesters, and I don't remember. Maybe we had a little extra time. I can't recall that. But I know that the students worked a great deal, and I think that the library probably was well enough organized that they knew that boxes 1 to 6 were going to go on shelf.
Somebody had to organize all that.
Somebody organized that.
Well, I thought this was kind of humorous, though. In this yearbook here, 1931, in the very back of it, there's this little article called Great Migration.
Oh.
And it talks about the some of the things. Reflections.
That's right. We had plenty of those puddles. Now this, of course, this was all from the old school.
Yeah, that's the old.
I don't know what this is supposed to be. I can't tell for sure.
That's the top of a car, it looks like. Yeah, it's the top of a car, but that's at the old campus, isn't it?
I think it's the end of it. I think it's a view of the old campus building from, what would it be, Normal or the end of El Cajon, but I'm guessing on that a little bit. And this has to be someplace at the old building. We didn't always have room inside, and apparently this is one of the outdoor concerts that they're getting organized for, I think.
What was this? It's 50 cents an hour by the administration to learn the nuances of loafing. Tales are told of the two men who slept on a little theater roof, the man who spent a morning looking for a dustpan, and a lout who received $4 a day to read magazines in the sagebrush.
I don't think there were as many of those as they say. I think they were having a little bit of fun, and it could be. I mean, I wouldn't put it past some of them. But the point was that, by and large, jobs were too scarce, and they were too anxious to hang on to them.
Okay.
There weren't too much, I don't think there was too much about that. Oh, I think you always find some freeloaders. Just as you find some loafers in class, you know, they're just human beings.
These old yearbooks are sometimes just wonderful. The sense of humor really shows through.
Well, hey, we had some very capable people, some very capable writers. Victor Whittaker, do you know Victor Whittaker?
No, I don't
know. Well, Victor Whittaker, and I always have a hard time with that name. I think was the Aztec editor for quite a while. Then he worked for many years for the Union Publishing Company, and then he was at the head of EGO, you know what EGO is?
Educational Growth Opportunities.
And he has just resigned as head of that.
I should recognize his name then.
And I saw him on the campus, a couple of months ago. I went out there to a luncheon, maybe not that long ago. He's still around. And he was, there were a number of, I wish I can remember the names of some of the other people.
I should have written some down.
We had some very good people who eventually went on and stayed in the publishing business. Victor is the only one that I can name right this minute.
They certainly put
Carl
out good
Johnson.
Publications.
Pardon?
They put out good publications.
Yes, they were smart kids. They were really smart people. And there was more of an emphasis on college, as you suggested. There weren't as many other things. There weren't people carrying other jobs.
They were dedicated to their work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was a lot more fun. I think college was a lot more fun in those days. I really do. I mean, there was a personal element and a certain kind of enthusiasm that I think sparked as a result.
Mm-hmm. I have also heard about the emphasis put on a general overall humanities education as opposed to what a lot of students are getting now, business
Well, we didn't have much of a business school. We had a course in business methods, which was for teachers who were going to go out into high school and teach typing and shorthand and bookkeeping. And I think that was it.
So for the most part, the students were pursuing either some kind of scientific field or humanities,
my first course, they were primarily teachers, but that changed pretty rapidly.
Uh-huh.
And they began to take additional courses, and a great many, as I say, took two years and then went on someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
I look back on, there are several things. One is the distance lens enchantment. You know, you remember the pleasantest things. It was also kind of an exciting time because it was new. The campus was new to the students.
Mm-hmm.
I was new to the job. I was also much closer to their age. That was something else.
Yeah, that's right.
And of course, as time goes on, that difference is bound to grow, and you'd have a different. I did a lot of work with the sororities, for instance.
You did.
As a sorority.
Tell me about that. I didn't realize that.
Well, every sorority had to have an advisor, and we had an inter-sorority council, to which the president of the sorority came, and we discussed rules of conduct and scholarship problems and all that sort of thing. What kind of dances they were going to put on and all those terribly important things that sororities discuss. What about rushing, and what scholarship did they have to maintain to stay in the sorority?
Mm-hmm.
All of which was pretty carefully discussed. Well, for several years, I was the inter-sorority council advisor. In other words, I was the boogeyman. And you know, the students get enthusiastic about some idea they're going to put on. And the first few times, they have an impossible dream. You are patient with them, and you may have to say, okay, you can't do that. But as time goes on, it gets harder and harder after you've been through this thing a few dozen times, that they want to rent the Hotel Del Coronado and they haven't got the money for it, you know, a few things like that. So, as I say, I look back on the period of the 30s probably with more enthusiasm because I was closer to their age.
After a while of serving as a sorority advisor, did you, and saying it's impossible for you to do this, you have to choose something else that's going to be a little more within your reach. Did you eventually just say, go ahead and try it and see what happens,
well,
let them flow?
On some of them we did. You had to try to keep the kids from just getting themselves hopelessly in debt. You know, this is what they want to do. You know, and then the students who had made that decision would be out of college, perhaps. And somebody else will be left holding the sack.
Probably.
This is one of the things you had to, you see, when something was done in the name of the organization, next year's kids might have to assume that burden. I mean, there were complications like that. So you had to say, okay, there's a limit to what you can do. And by and large, it wasn't that difficult. I remember a few times kind of knocking heads and persuading people that, as I say, they couldn't rent the hotel in New York, and they couldn't possibly finance it. And you could quote, you know, okay, somebody tried it once was enough on that particular fiasco.
Did the geography students have a student group?
Yes, we had two student groups. We had a lower division group that I think Miss Clark called the Chuckawallas. And there was an upper division group for a time, I think we're called Roadrunners. And they had Sunday field trips sometimes, picnics,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing.
They were sponsoring speakers?
Yes. I remember one Italian. We had lectures. Those groups kind of came and went. You know, you get a bunch that were enthusiastic, and the next, in a couple of years, you know, the next semester, some of those people would be gone. But those groups continued for quite a little while. As I say, a lot of the time it was a matter of every so often going out to see the spring flowers or something like that. That was before we had regular field trips with our classes for that.
Speaking of field trips, what did you do to the way of field trips? Where did you take your students for your classes to really get them gung-ho about the subject?
We had a beautiful trip. We, for quite a number of years in the late 30s, until we could no longer get gasoline, literally. We started earlier. I remember the first one of the first trips, Baylor Brooks and Dorothy Harvey and I each took about between 20 and 30 students in private cars to Borrego.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two hazards. One was the kids' cars, which were not always that reliable, and the other was the roads, which are not as good as they are today. And in Borrego itself, there were very few roads. And I remember we went up to the palms, you know where the palms
mm-hmm.
are?
Mm-hmm.
And there, I don't think there was any regular trail. It seems to me that the kids just climbed over those like a bunch of goats. Baylor took care of the geology, and Dorothy took care of the botany. I took care of the development of the area. And because all three of us were interested in trying to get the kids out to really look at these things and not just look at pictures in a book.
Uh-huh.
And I remember coming back. I didn't take my car. Maybe it was too early. Well, anyhow, I remember I was riding with Baylor, and we counted heads and noses and got everybody started home again. And we knew that there were no more students lurking under a cactus or anything. Gave them a good start, and we were the last car. We got about three-fourths of the way up the Banner Grade, and we came on a car that was stalled. It had about five girls in it, in hysterics, because it was getting dark, and they didn't know, A, what was wrong with the car, and they didn't know whether there was anyone behind them or not. And it's a long, lonely way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't,
it's a long way, huh?
It wasn't that serious. I don't remember all the details, but what had actually happened is in jolting over those rutty roads, the battery had become disconnected, because in those old cars, the battery was held in by a strap, and the jolting had broken it loose, and the battery had dropped down and just disconnected the car. You know, that was
mm-hmm.
almost to it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember whether Baylor discovered that, or whether it wasn't very far on to Julian. But anyhow, we got the girls. And I didn't blame them for being hysterical, because they didn't know really where they were, or how far it was any place, or was anyone behind them. It was getting dark. And
you got your own students back home.
Oh, they were all home. Later on, that would be private cars. But as soon as I think by the middle 30s, we began to hire buses for a number of reasons.
For one, you'd have to worry about insurance liability and all
and
that.
And you didn't have to worry about a car breaking down. And you had them all there with a public address system in the bus. You could stop and you had them all there to look at that thing. But if you hadn't strung out the half a dozen cars, you know, you didn't know how soon you'd get them all together. And it made it much, much better. And it wasn't.
Did you have to worry about any of the requirements of getting the approval of? No, I guess you wouldn't need that. The students probably were old enough so that they were their own bosses, and then you didn't have to get the approval of their parents to take them on
the
field trip.
No,
not
no.
anymore.
That would happen. That would be true probably in an elementary school.
That's
it
true.
Wasn't true there. No, the only difficulty was to try to part the students from their money. And I don't remember, but it was a couple of dollars or something like that in the beginning. And you know how students are without spending money, they're going to spend it on a movie or something. They're not enough to part with it to go on a trip if they can help it. But we required it in the beginning class, at least I did, and I guess Ms. Clark did too. Then when the war came along, we couldn't get gasoline, that was that. And I was never able to persuade everybody to get started again. But it was, I think, one of the most valuable things that we did. Because the students I see now who come to me, someone just the other day said, well, I guess it was one of the faculty members, he said, who had been in my class, and said, you know, I still remember those field trips and I learned a lot.
Oh, yeah, it makes a big impression on the students.
It takes time. And I got down.
I don't think I have.
Well, we got down past setting that canyon. You know the Banner Grade?
Yes, I know.
And then you go through setting that canyon, this narrow canyon, with that nice little stream, and then that opens up into a sandy kind of a plain. Well, we had our lunch at Banner, and it gets us started at 8 o'clock, and this was getting on toward 1:30 or 2 o'clock, and they were getting kind of antsy and kind of tired. And we had one little head stop to make, and I gave them this pitch, do not horse around. Footing is uncertain on that sand, and just take it easy, and we can, we're off ahead to someplace else. Well, you know what happened? One fellow spotted another one or something, turned to, it was all horse, just horse play. Sure. It was good natured.
They're doing what you told them not to do.
But he lost his footing, as you can, in that loose sand. Mm-hmm. Went into a cactus.
Oh, no.
Into a, one of those,
Choya or
Choya.
A jumping Choya.
Fortunately, he got it only on his forearms and on his chest. How he missed his face, I don't know. Mm. And there was a girl along who was a student nurse or something. I remember we tried tweezers, we took pliers, and we pulled out some of the worst of those things.
Those things are rough to pull.
They are nasty. And I don't remember whether a car stopped or whether I flagged a car down and asked them if they would take him back to town, because he still had a lot of them. And we couldn't deal with him. Not while 30 kids stood around him.
anxious to leave.
He went to the police department because his father was a police surgeon, I think. In any case, he went to the police department to make contact with the doctor. And there were some reporters around on Saturday afternoon with apparently nothing to do.
Oh, no.
So, the story. This was something to work up. And believe it or not, in the Los Angeles Times the next morning, in a box on the front page, was the story which was headed, I've forgotten what the heading exactly, it was something like instructor faints. It was just beautiful. As a matter of fact, I was talking to a couple of students the other day about it, and they were still howling. They just laughed about it. The fellow incident came out all right. He had his arms, his chest bandaged for a few days. You know, each one of those little things has a little, like a little,
this backwards
thing on it. There's like a little barb on there. And this, each one of those places was a little bit infected.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't serious.
Mm-hmm.
But thank God it didn't get in his face.
Oh, yeah. I thought he slid right down on the
The next day, or the next, and I don't remember this particularly, but the students assured me that it happened on Monday after that. I read them the section out of the newspaper, and they were just guffawing at such a rate that somebody from the chemistry department next door came in. I think we're having a riot in there.
Did you get into trouble from the administration for anything like that? No, they didn't get after you?
No. We were trying to be very careful. We carried snake venom. You know, I mean, anti-snake stuff. That was my favorite nightmare.
Have you ever had any disasters like that?
No, never did. The only one, the nearest thing, we have never had a disaster, but in the very early days, I remember Miss Clark and I took 6 or 8 upper division students down to Banner, and we camped there for the weekend, and went up to the Banner mine, and we went up to the top of the mountain range next to the, I don't know what they call it now, but anyhow, we went in groups of 2 or 3s, and I think maybe there were only about 6 or 7 students at that time. And I remember I and 2 of the men students were going down, not the present Banner Grade, but the old road, which is up higher. You can just barely see the trace of it now. They're still there, And I was about to step, on those trips out there, I wore boots that were laced to the knees, as a lot of people did.
It's a good idea.
And I was about to step down, and here was a rattlesnake curled up neatly. Well, Benny Benbow, who's now since gone to his reward, was carrying a gun. He'd done a great deal of snooping and hunting in the backcountry.